My father loves the movie Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is a movie from 1993 that stars Bill Murray. In it, Bill Murray plays a weatherman named Phil Connors, who is forced to travel to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, to cover Groundhog Day, whether the groundhog sees his shadow or not. While he is there, Phil Connors becomes stuck in a time loop, where he is forced to relive this particular day over and over again. As you watch this movie, it seems as though he relives this day hundreds of times. And you even start to wonder if there's anything poor Phil Connors can do to escape this time loop. As it turns out, he was able to escape when he learned what he needed to learn and changed. I am sure that this movie kept coming to mind because of its similarities to the book of Judges. You see, highlighted throughout the book of Judges is a vicious cycle that the Israelites too become stuck in and are forced to live and relive. In fact, even as believers, many of us find ourselves stuck in cycles as well, wondering if there's any way for us to escape. So, in a very real way, we have the exact same challenge that Phil Connors had in Groundhog Day. We want to identify what is causing the cycles that we find ourselves in, and then make the necessary changes to put an end to these cycles. Those are the tasks before us, and those are the tasks before the ancient Israelites as well. So let's get started. I'll start reading in Judges chapter 1, starting in verse 1. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites inquired of the Lord, "Who will be the first to fight for us against the Canaanites?" The Lord answered, "Judah is to go. I have handed the land over to him." God handed the land over to the Israelites. And most of chapter 1 tells us the successes that they had. You may have noticed some overlap between Judges chapter 1 and events that were told in the book of Joshua. The purpose here is just to give us some background information. As you read, there were many things that could have stood out to you. Perhaps the first thing that drew your attention was the very odd account that we were told in verses 6 and 7 about Adoni Bezek. I wish that I could tell you that this is the only odd thing we are going to come across in the book of Judges. However, I would be lying to you. There are many odd things in the book of Judges. And I know enough about the Word of God to know that each and every one of these things is here for a reason. I'm sure there's some scholar somewhere who has done a whole bunch of research and has a very interesting paper on Adoni Bezek, but we would be in the book of Judges for a very long time if we set as our goal to dig into each and everything that drew our attention. So I'm going to take the opportunity right now to lay before you a different approach. Instead of allowing ourselves to get distracted by things like Adoni Bezek and his thumbs and big toes, or lack thereof, I'm going to propose that we stay focused on the major points and learning opportunities in the book of Judges. We are going to have to be very diligent in order to do this. So now that we've agreed to set aside some of the odd things we come across, there are actually many things that we should notice in the first chapter of Judges. The first thing we should notice is that the Israelites worked in tandem with God. They inquired of the Lord responded. They fought, the Lord gave victory. We should also notice that the Israelites' progress involved a fight, and they had to keep fighting. If they got distracted or their resolve waned, progress simply stalled. As we progress through chapter 1, we see victory, and then partial victory, and then once we get to verse 27, we are told of a series of failures. Over and over again, we were told that they failed to drive out the Canaanites. They failed to take possession of this city or that city. This is the background information that the author of Judges felt was necessary in order to set up for us what we are told in chapter 2. Chapter 2 introduces us to the cycle that we are going to see throughout the book of Judges. So let's start by answering the question, what is the cycle? We will get all kinds of nuance as we study each of these cycles, but at its basic level, the cycle looks like this. The Israelites did something that God considered evil. The Lord responded by handing them over to their enemies, and they were oppressed. But when they cried out to God, God raised up a judge who would save them from the power of their enemies. That judge would lead the Israelites to victory, secure peace, and that peace would last throughout the lifetime of the judge. But after the judge died, the people again did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the cycle started again. As we progress through the book of Judges, we are going to get a total of 6 iterations of this cycle. It is going to feel like Groundhog Day. So now that we know what the cycle is, let's turn our attention to what caused the cycle. What was the evil that the Israelites did? If the goal is to avoid entering into sin and oppression cycles, we need to know exactly what they did so that we can avoid it. In both sections of chapter 2, where the Lord addressed the Israelites, he made reference to their covenant with him. In fact, in verse 20, he said that they violated his covenant. The Israelites violating their covenant with God is what caused these cycles. We are going to spend a few minutes on covenant. One, because I think it's very important, and also because I think it is very easy to misunderstand. Although believers, so the Israelites in Judges had a covenant with God. It was called the Mosaic Covenant, or what we refer to now as the Old Covenant. Although believers are not under the same covenant with God, the Israelites' covenant with God helps us understand our covenant better. When the Israelites were in Egypt, enslaved and oppressed, they cried out to God, and God moved on their behalf to save them. Their salvation actually had a couple of components to it. First and foremost, God made them right with himself. When they placed the blood of the lamb on the Passover lamb on the doorposts of their houses, God accepted the blood of the lamb on their behalf. The lamb died so that they didn't have to. After God made them right with himself, he freed them from the power of their enemy. In their case, it was Egypt. And he led them away from the place of their enslavement to the base of Mount Sinai. It was at the base of Mount Sinai that God proposed a covenant with the Israelites. And the offer was this: he would be their God, and they would be his people. And the Israelites readily accepted this offer. In fact, they agreed to be God's people by doing whatever God said before God even said it. Do we have any lawyers here? I mean, that could seem a little foolish, right? I really think you guys should have read the fine print before you accepted. However, I really don't think that the ancient Israelites were foolish. In fact, I think they were more wise than most of humanity today. Corrie ten Boom once said, "Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God." The Israelites that left Egypt knew God. They had experienced something so powerful that they didn't even need to ask God, "Just tell me what you want me to do. Tell me how I should live and I'll do it." They had no doubt that God existed and that he was greater than all the other so-called gods of Egypt. And also, they were fully aware of their own inability to save or lead or guide themselves. So it was really quite logical for them to say, "Hey God, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it." It was logical for them, and it remains logical for humanity today, to have this posture toward the Lord. If we do not, it is likely because we simply do not yet know him well enough. So the Israelites readily entered into covenant with God. Let's look at some of the important components of their covenant with God. In their covenant, the Israelites agreed that God would be their God, the one they would depend on to lead them and to guide them. They also agreed that they would be his people. They would follow him and obey him. They entered into covenant with a covenant ceremony. It was formal. It was inaugurated in blood. As part of their covenant, the Israelites agreed to adopt God's laws as the legal code that would govern their nation. So God revealed to them through the law how he wanted them to live, and they agreed to actually live that way. And God also provided the punishments for breaking the law so that they would know fair consequences. Many of the laws that God gave the ancient Israelites were related to the sacrificial system. At its most basic level, the sacrificial system was how God's people maintained a right relationship with the Lord. So when a person or the leaders or the nation as a whole sinned, all was not lost. They simply acknowledged their wrongdoing, brought the required offering, and they were forgiven. When God's people lived in accordance with God's laws, they reflected him and his values to the world around them. When they did not, God was faithful to discipline them in order to bring them back into right relationship with him. So I hope you can see that the Israelites' covenant with God was very comprehensive. It covered a lot of things. Now that was just a nutshell view of it. There's much more to it. But that's their covenant with God in a nutshell. Throughout the Old Testament, God foretold that he would replace the old covenant with the new covenant. And he was specific about why. We saw it when we looked at our homework. It was because the people did not continue in covenant with God. They kept violating it. Understanding the components of the old covenant helps us understand better our covenant with God, the new covenant. Like the Israelites, we are saved, made right with God, and freed from the power of our enemy when we simply cry out to God. But from there, we see some changes. Whereas the Israelites entered into covenant with the blood of bulls, we enter into covenant by the blood of God's own Son, Jesus Christ. The Israelites were expected to obey God, and God gave them his instructions on tablets of stone. Believers are still expected to obey God. But instead of writing his instructions on tablets of stone, the Bible says he writes them on our hearts, and he gives us his very spirit so that we can walk in obedience to him. Like the Israelites, God uses our obedience to reflect him and his values to the world around us. And he will discipline us in order to bring us back into right relationship with him. Both covenants provided a way for forgiveness to be obtained. For believers today, we confess our sins and Jesus is faithful and just to forgive us and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Our covenant with God is comprehensive too. The heart of both the Israelites' covenant with God and believers' covenant with God is that God would be our God, the one we depend on, follow, worship, serve, obey. Understanding our covenant with God can relieve some fears that we might have about what causes sin and oppression cycles. God did not expect his people to be perfect. The very severe response we see from the Lord toward his people was not for every sin. Poor Phil Connors really did not know what was causing him to have to redo Groundhog Day over and over again. But when we look closely, we can see what causes the sin and oppression cycle that we see in the book of Judges, and perhaps even in our own lives. And it's this: idolatry. God's covenant people abandoning God by following, worshiping, and serving other gods. I know that it might be very tempting to shake our heads at the Israelites. Like, why? Why would you abandon God? And I certainly suppose that it is possible that they made a conscious decision to abandon God and put their allegiance towards other gods. But the more time I've spent in this book, and I've spent almost a year in it, the less sure I am of that. And I think that we will get the most out of our study if we will be open to the possibility that the Israelites did not think that they were abandoning God. And if we are honest with ourselves, we might start to see some areas where we are depending on someone or something other than God, where we might be following, worshiping, serving other things. I can tell you that I think it is far more subtle than I originally thought. At the heart of our covenant with God is that God would be our God. So what does it mean for God to be our God? I'm going to tell you right now what it is not. It is not simply acknowledging that he exists. That wasn't good enough for Pharaoh. After those 10 plagues, he certainly knew that God exists. But if you need a little more convincing, let's take a look at James 2:19. You say you have faith, for you believe that there is one God. Good for you. Even the demons believe this, and they tremble in terror. Believing that God exists is a step in the right direction, but it does not make God our God. In order for God to be our God, we must be in covenant with him. We must have cried out to him and accepted the finished work of Jesus Christ on our behalf. And when we are in covenant with God, God seems to care a whole lot about us treating him as if he actually is our God. The heart of idolatry is God's covenant people treating something or someone else like their God when we already have a God. So, what caused the Israelites to enter into idolatry? Let's see. The people worshiped the Lord throughout Joshua's lifetime. They had seen all the Lord's great works he had done for Israel. So far, so good. After them, another generation rose up who did not know the Lord or the works he had done for Israel. They did what was evil in the Lord's sight. They abandoned the Lord. They followed other gods. So notice, the cycle started with the next generation. The Canaanites that remained in the land and their gods really didn't have an effect on that first generation. That generation that knew the Lord continued to worship the Lord. The results were seen in the next generation. Now, in case we want to place all the blame on that first generation that failed to fully take possession of the promised land, I do not think the text will allow us to do that. Chapter 3 tells us directly that the Lord did not give a full and complete victory to that generation. The Lord left these nations, and he did it on purpose. God seems to care a whole lot about each generation coming to know him and then intentionally choosing to make him their God. When we look at what caused the Israelites to enter into idolatry, we see that it happened in this transition between generations. The next generation of Israelites certainly would have been affected by the faith of their parents. Their parents had opportunities to teach them about the Lord, to take them to worship the Lord, but it seems that they were also profoundly affected by the Canaanites and the gods they served. If believers want to avoid entering into sin and oppression cycles, we need to avoid idolatry. And if idolatry is more subtle than we might originally think, it might be sort of hard to notice in our own lives. So how do we identify idolatry in our lives? I have a couple of ideas on this. Idolatry started in the transition between generations. So the first thing we can do is look at our faith in a much broader context. We need to consider that we are our parents' next generation. As someone's next generation, we have been impacted positively or negatively by the faith of our parents, what they taught us or didn't teach us, what they modeled for us or didn't model for us, affects how we think about God. It affects how we draw near to him, what we invite him into, and what we leave him out of. Now, some of us were not raised in Christian homes, so we're basically starting from scratch. But even those of us who were raised to know and love the Lord can have some blind spots based on the blind spots of our parents or something just getting lost in the transition. We also, whether we realize it or not, are profoundly affected by culture. The culture we grew up in affects what is important to us. So what are some of the gods of our culture? There are so many. How about wealth, career, physical appearance, perfectionism, productivity, comfort, pleasure, self-sufficiency? Looking at the transition between generations can help us see what idols we might have as a result of how we were raised and the culture in which we live. Another way to look for areas of idolatry is how we make our decisions. We have so many decisions that we make. Some are important: where we go to school, who we marry, where we live. Some are urgent. We need an answer right now. Many are mundane. What should I do today? How we approach our decisions can show us areas where we might be prone to some form of idolatry. I tend to be an I'm going to figure it out kind of person. So if I'm not careful, when I come to a decision or a problem, I might be prone to sort of push ahead, try to figure it out on my own. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to weigh the pros and the cons, maybe do some Google searches, talk to some people that I respect. But if I am treating God like my God, I will pray first. And then I will allow him to show me the things I need to think about, the pros and the cons, what I should Google, who I should talk to. Do you see the subtlety there? Just like we have been impacted by the faith of our parents and the culture in which we grew up, our children will be affected by what they learn from us and the culture in which they grow up, because they are our next generation. Now, in case you are getting depressed, it's actually a very good thing to come to know potential areas of idolatry in our lives, because then we can just reject them and put our faith back in the Lord. And the antidote to idolatry is actually very simple. Come to know the Lord. The more we come to know the Lord, the less and less we will be affected by how we were raised and the culture in which we live. We will see how good God is, and we will be less and less likely to accept cheap counterfeits. And it's the same for our children. So our goal is to help them come to know God. We want to tell them about God. We want to model for them an authentic relationship with the Lord. We want to fill in any gaps we think they're having that's getting lost in the transition by explaining things to them. And most importantly, encouraging them to draw near to God themselves so that they will come to know the Lord. I've told some of you that this book, the book of Judges, has very profoundly impacted my day-to-day life. And this is one area. You see, up until recently, I would pray over my kids each day. And of course, over time, they'd be like, hey, Mom, can you pray for my finger? And they'd add a whole bunch of things to my prayer list. And I would be like, yes, of course. But now, I am very intentionally stopping and saying, yes, of course, I will pray for your finger. But you pray for your finger. You pray for your finger right now. And my daughter, like, she's about to go to middle school, so she gets to pick, like, one class now. So I'm like, pray and ask God and give him a little bit of time to show you which elective you should do. Because I want the Lord to be as real to my children as he is to me. I want them to have an opportunity to see that he actually shows up. He actually will communicate with you and he will help you. So back to the cycle. What should we do about these cycles? Our first step in avoiding sin and oppression cycles is going to be to not enter into them in the first place. And we do that by avoiding idolatry, which we just talked a whole bunch about. But if we are in a cycle, the thing we need to do is cry out to God. I have to tell you, it took the Israelites a ridiculously long amount of time to cry out to God. And I have to wonder, did they not realize that they were in a sin oppression cycle? Is it possible that we are in or have been in for a very long time due to some form of idolatry, a sin and oppression cycle, and we don't even realize it? When the Israelites finally cried out to God, God had mercy on them. When we realize, or even think that we might be, in a sin and oppression cycle, even one we brought on ourselves, even one that we've been in for most of our lives, for the love of God, let's cry out to God. When they cried out to him, God responded by raising up a judge to deliver them. Please notice something. Up until the Israelites abandoned God, their enemies were basically kept at bay. When they abandoned God, God removed his protection, and their enemies gained power against them. So it stands to reason that after they cried out to God, God could have just caused their enemies to lose power against them, to just go away. But he didn't do that. God did not just magically remove the Israelites' problems. Instead, he raised up deliverers for them to follow. All of the Bible is consistently pointing to the deliverance that God offers through his son, Jesus Christ. We saw it when we looked at the covenants, and we see it here in Judges over and over again when God shows that if we are to be freed from the power of our enemies, we must follow his deliverer. After we cry out to God, we need to look for how he is pointing us to follow his son, Jesus Christ. So after getting an overview of the cycle, in chapter 3, we saw the first two iterations of it. So at the time of Joshua's death, there remained Canaanites in the promised land. God left them there on purpose to teach and to test the next generation. But they settled among them and worshiped their gods. And the first cycle starts. In this first cycle, we see that the evil that the Israelites did was that they forgot the Lord and worshiped other gods. So God sold them to King Cushan of Aram. They served him for 8 years until they cried out to the Lord. In response to their cry, God raised up Othniel, the nephew and son-in-law of Caleb. The Spirit of the Lord came on him. He led the Israelites to victory, and they had peace for 40 years, essentially one generation. But then, presumably after that generation passed away, the Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord gave King Eglon of Moab power over them, and they served him for 18 years. 18 years before they cried out to God. When they cried out to him, God raised up a man named Ehud. There are a lot of very interesting details in this account. However, at its most basic level, Ehud secured victory by attacking King Eglon, escaping, rallying the troops. He became their leader, and he secured a peace that lasted 80 years, two generations. As we wrap up today, in the final verse of chapter 3, we were told quickly of the third judge, Shamgar. Although we didn't get any details into the cycle, we were told that he delivered Israel from the Philistines. Phil Connors very much wanted to get out of the cycle of repeating Groundhog Day. And in order to do that, he had to change. We are going to see that the Israelites kept repeating their cycle of sin and oppression because they kept abandoning God by following, worshiping, and serving other gods. And I believe that many of the sin oppression cycles that believers today find themselves living and reliving have as their root cause this same thing, modern day idolatry. As we continue in our study of Judges, let's be diligent in rooting idolatry out of our lives. Let's allow the Lord to show us the cycles that we are caught in. Let's cry out to him about each and every area of oppression in our lives. And let's look to our deliverer, Jesus Christ, to lead us.